Welcome to Federalist 2.0. This is a new podcast where we explore the ways in which the Constitution, our instruction manual for how to run a government, could be improved. I'm your host, Jeff, and you can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Now, on with the show. All right, well, on today's episode, we see a return to our roots and another discussion about the merits of federalism. We also talk some more about advice and consent. We delve into an area near and dear to my heart, the dismal science of economics. All that on today's episode of Federalist 2.0. We've talked at length about the governing construct for the country, the balance between various constituencies, and the needs for all voices to be heard. But I think it's worth spending a little bit more time talking about perhaps the most controversial of those constituencies, the states. You'll find very few people arguing against the rights of individuals. And most people will acknowledge that ultimately government exists to protect the country and all of us. But the states invariably evoke a different sort of emotion. Part of this is historical. Most people consider themselves Americans first and Georgians or Californians second. In some places, even the city is more important than the state. Someone born and raised in Chicago is far more likely to answer Chicago than they are to say Illinois when asked where they're from. Because of this, we've diminished the role of states. We've slowly chipped away at both their power and our expectations of them. Frequently, we turn to the federal government to correct state wrongs or state deficiencies. Take the always controversial Affordable Care Act. Health insurance was, by law, a state-level issue. You were prohibited from selling insurance across state lines, and states had their own insurance regulators that dealt with it. But over many years, states allowed this system to become increasingly broken. I don't think that's a particularly controversial statement to make. And rather than hold the state legislators accountable, we clamored for a national solution. But why? Because we've overemphasized the role of federal government. With this revamping of the Constitution that we're doing, we should right those wrongs and reemphasize the role that states should have. As I've talked about before, this will undoubtedly lead to some bad policy at the state level, but it will likewise lead to some really good policy as well. And we need the states to provide a robust laboratory of ideas so that we can find the very best policies that work for the people of the United States. So to promote this, we should try to encourage a couple things in the states. Self-reliance. We shouldn't have the federal government taxing money at the federal level simply to send it right back to the states. If the states need that money, they should tax it themselves. It creates weird economic distortions when we do it the way we're doing it now. It encourages free riding by the states. Likewise, we shouldn't permit states or subdivisions thereof to provide targeted incentives to attract businesses. One of the policies most abhorrent to good government is unequal treatment under the law. When this unequal treatment occurs simply to attract a new factory to an area, it becomes particularly galling to everyone. So states, counties, and cities should have policies that they think strike the best balance between attracting business and enriching the lives of their citizenry. And businesses and people are then free to come and go as they please, voting with their feet, as it were. But we shouldn't allow some sort of bidding competition to occur to attract specific entities. Frankly, finally, I think it's worth considering some sort of federal override. The federal government shouldn't generally pass laws that govern how states regulate things within their power, like insurance. However, I think it's fair to say that if the laboratory of the states comes up with a solution that looks to be the very best, then with sufficient political will, that solution maybe should be imposed on all the states. However, it shouldn't be done by a bare majority. Instead, it should be subject to some elevated threshold representing a clear, unambiguous exercise of political mandate. If such a level of certainty doesn't exist, then the states should be left to implement their own solution and perhaps find an even better one. So something like a 2/3 or a 75% or a 60% majority, the number is not particularly important. It's just important that it's higher than a simple majority. And at that point, you could push a solution onto the states. So let's move on and talk about the legislative role of advice and consent. It's largely been twisted and morphed from its original intent, and away from what I would consider good governance. This has been most apparent in the nomination of in 2016 of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, but it had been the case in other nominations throughout the Clinton, Bush, and Obama eras prior. Presidential appointments for things like the cabinet, the judiciary, and ambassadorships are requisite components for the good functioning of the government. We need those people doing those jobs. Our current system permits a bare majority of the Senate to simply deny that function for no other reason than discriminatory policy. This seems really improper to me. This has only been made worse by the new way in which the Senate stays in session, therefore denying recess appointments, the so-called pro forma sessions that are conducted these days, deny a basic constitutional prerogative of the president. We can change the process to remove it, or at least lessen much of this dysfunction. The current process requires the president to make a nominee, and then the Senate holds confirmation hearings, and eventually a confirmation vote, theoretically. If the Senate doesn't like the nominee or simply doesn't like the president's policies, they can vote against the nominee or even refuse to hold hearings as they did with Merrick Garland. So let's address the latter first. The refusal to hold hearings is essentially no different than the chamber being on recess for purposes of this discussion. Thus, the first change that I think we should make would be to tweak that, and if within some time period, say 30 to 60 days of a nomination, if the chamber doesn't hold a confirmation vote on a particular nominee, we should just consider that a recess appointment. And they'll serve until a confirmation vote is conducted. But we might still have issues where the chamber decides that they simply don't like the president's politics and therefore are going to vote to deny all of their nominees. We haven't really seen this happen. Typically, the perception is that there would be a political price to pay and that this kind of toxic relationship, there would be that political price. But the problem is that that price wouldn't come due for 2 to 6 years, depending on which chamber we're talking about. And the damage done in the meantime could be pretty high. So to prevent this, I think we should allow for two different thresholds of confirmation. If a majority of the consenting chamber agrees, then the nominee just is confirmed as normal. So if you get 51%, nominee happens just like normal. But there should be some lower threshold, I don't know, 35, 40, 45%, some level there at that level, where the nominee can function on an interim basis, subject to additional future votes, and not surviving the end of the current presidential term. So the president could then appoint cabinet members. They wouldn't necessarily need 50%. They would need, 35, 40, 45%. And they could have those cabinet nominees for their term. They could have judges even to overhear cases, but again, limited by their term. So those two changes would really help to ensure the inner workings of government are always able to function, while also keeping the requirement that the legislature and the executive generally agree on a particular candidate. Lastly, before we move on from the legislature, let's take a detour to discuss modern economics. Now, there's a fair bit of political rhetoric that gets tied and twisted around with economic wordplay. Socialism gets equated to dictatorship. Capitalism is assumed to mean laissez-faire capitalism. The line between oligarchy and corporatocracy is pretty muddy at best. Let's take a step back and remember the ground rules of this whole exercise, that it is not our role in constructing a new and better instruction book to dictate how the players will play the game. Policy should not be our concern in this exercise. Deciding whether or not the government owns steel production or if banks should be regulated really should be left to elected officials. However, we should have a recognition that, at least out of the gate, our country is likely to be some flavor of free market capitalism. Now, my personal belief is that the adage, capitalism is the worst economic system except for all others, is pretty accurate. That's formed by my education as an economist and my experience in the financial industry. Capitalism sucks, except that there isn't really anything better. But that belief that capitalism is ultimately the best approach comes with some really big caveats. We should have our eyes wide open with this subject. We should understand the drawbacks of capitalism, the system that we've chosen, and ensure that our legislature has the tools to address them. In fact, we should be encouraging them to address them. Now, there are three areas in which any economist will tell you capitalism struggles: monopoly and monopsony, which are sort of two sides of the same coin, externalities, and something called inferior goods. Now, each of these deserves its own segment. In fact, whole college classes are taught on individual subjects of these. But that's beyond the scope of this discussion. I'm happy to have it with people that are interested. Feel free to email, but it's beyond what I'm going to talk about here in depth. Suffice it to say that any free market economy that doesn't seek to regulate these things will inevitably have portions of their economy that fail to function to the benefit of all. In addition to these areas, there are requisite components of a free market economy. So what I mean by that is price transparency, for example. If you don't know how much you're paying for a good or service, then one of the fundamental features of capitalism, price signaling, fails to manifest. This is one of the root causes of the problems in the healthcare system, in fact, a near complete lack of price transparency. Now, classically, there are four requirements: property rights, freedom of private enterprise, profits and prices, and competitive markets. In fact, we can see that our three failures of capitalism we talked about before actually undermine specific components of this. Externalities occur when property rights are undermined or aren't articulated properly. Monopolies are by definition uncompetitive markets, inferior goods are where the price signals aren't being driven properly by supply and demand. Essentially, because we've chosen to follow capitalism, we must necessarily allow and encourage the legislature to govern these facets of the economy as well. But, and I think this is very important, this may not always be the case. As we come to understand economics better, we may realize there are other areas that need to be legislated, other requirements of capitalism that we sort of take for granted. Or we might even find ourselves 50 years from now having realized that there is a better economic system, something that benefits even more people, and we shouldn't be locked into this current form of economics. Remember, policy is not our purview here. So while I would advocate spelling out these legislative roles in our new constitution, I would also suggest a mechanism that they could be changed, something that revolves around a very clear, proper popular mandate, something that's also agreed upon by the legislature. So I would structure it like this, and this is me sort of throwing something out up for discussion. I'm not locked into any of this, but I think this general structure makes sense. So if a majority vote in all three houses occurs, that would trigger a national vote that could be put forward that allows for a very limited and specific form of amendment to the Constitution. This would allow the powers of legislature to regulate economic activity to be changed. And that would happen if that national vote received a 2/3 vote from the population, as long as at least half of the states pass it by a majority, or by a 3/4 vote of the population, and that would ignore the requirement of the states. So to avoid these, and then on top of that, I think it would be really important that these not be done as snap elections, right? We shouldn't have these kind of decisions done quickly. They should be done after a national debate. So I think the change should be voted on by the legislature. That would trigger a vote that's at least 12 months out, and a vote that can only be done in the odd number of years, because I think distancing it from the personalities of politics is also good. So, and then on top of all those safeguards, right, we would also make it so the first vote would be a temporary increase in that legislative power. And then a second vote 4 to 6 years later that would affirm that as a permanent legislative expansion. So I recognize that is far from a perfect solution. There are people that will come up with problems that will not solve, and we can address those. But it does address some of the key issues that we've had over the years. I think one of the big problems we've had in the weakening of the Interstate Commerce Clause, which has essentially been whittled down to almost nothing, it's been done largely through good intentions and out of perceived necessity, a recognition that Congress needed the power to regulate certain activities, but that the Constitution didn't actually permit it. And so we pushed on the borders of Interstate Commerce Clause, and that's what we decided to do to allow Congress to legislate these things. With this change, we would allow the populace to have a voice in the legislative domain of Congress. Now, we're not allowing the population to vote on individual laws. I think that's a bad idea. That would lead to a pretty reactionary legislation set anyway. But permitting the citizenry to formally opine on the governing limits strikes me as a particularly democratic solution. Thanks, guys. With 7 episodes now done, we're finally ready to move past the legislature and move on to the executive. Given how dramatic the changes we propose for the legislature are, how much do I suggest we change the executive? Well, the answer is a lot. I'm sure you're not surprised. Next time on Federalist 2.0. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Federalist 2.0. My name is Jeff. You can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Please remember to like and subscribe. Apparently, giving 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts really helps, so if you're using that service, please do that. And until next time, thank you and goodbye.